Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Vanilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dallas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Oh, thank you very much, Audrey. We could not do this without you. And how many times have we done this? This is show 6,221. Is that? No, it just seems like that. But thank you, Joe, for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, this evening. I think we'll have an interesting show. We certainly have an interesting speaker that we're going to work off from. And his name is James Antle. And he is going to talk about his book called Devouring Freedom, Can Big Government Ever Be Stopped? And I think that's a question that lots of people are starting to ask on both sides of the political spectrum. They come together, you know, if you go far enough in the extremes on a lot of issues, one becomes the other. But very interesting, gentlemen. And Mr. Antle is also the editor of the Daily Caller, the news foundation for that. And he's also the editor of American Conservative, and he's senior editor of American Spectator. So I think you'll enjoy his presentation tonight, and we'll try to work it in with some of the news stories we're going to be talking about. So you're listening to Blog Talk Radio. Remember, those of you who don't like this show can have your own in about 3 minutes. So you can sign off and go to blogtalkradio.com, sign up, and you could be broadcasting within, I'll bet, 15 minutes to have your own show, or set up a better show next week or in a few days. So it's a marvelous thing. I should comment, and I think some people already know about this, but Blog Talk Radio sent an announcement or two to all of us who are hosts on Blog Talk Radio. They have been hacked over the last couple weeks, and a couple of shows of mine, they didn't get all the way through. They stopped after like 20 minutes, and then I think another one didn't get through at all, but they've somebody's hacked in it, and they've got it all fixed now, so we hope this one sustains itself when we get through to the end, which is a little bit redundant. I want to thank our whole staff here, Audrey, of course, Audrey England, Mike Sorrento, Emily Springfield, and Lucy Spears. And Mildred's joining us tonight, and she's an assistant for Lucy, but actually she's an automated voice. Anyway, more about that later. Purpose of the show is to talk about usually news issues and events relative to criminal justice. And the things I'm going to skip tonight, I'm going to skip the murder case of the woman who killed her boyfriend, was found guilty, faces death penalty. I'm going to skip the Cleveland case, which is very interesting, and I'm going to skip all the business about Benghazi at this point because it's just been talked and talked and talked about, and there's more to come in all those cases. So some of the things are a little bit odd relative to the Cleveland case. I'll just mention one thing. I want to know, what is the beat police officer doing with all these odd things and unusual things going on in that guy's house? And they actually been called there a couple times. Who knows a neighborhood better than the beat police officers, not some detective sitting in an office somewhere? I'm not knocking detectives. They have follow-up responsibilities and undercover assignments and all that. But nobody knows the community and its specific beats within a community than the beat police officer. Somebody's worked there on a beat 10, 8, 10, 12, 14 years. They know what time you go to work. They know when you come home. They know who you ride with. I mean, on and on and on and on. That's just their business. So our show is dedicated, of course, to those tireless police and courts and corrections people and juvenile justice professionals. We have a news story about some things going on in the Baltimore, the jail, and just terrible. I mean, corrections officer is an incredibly difficult job, and the short story is that a gang sort of took over the jail and the corrections officer complied and sort of worked for them. We need to prosecute people to do that. But on the other hand, corrections officers probably don't make a lot of money, particularly at the municipal level, and not a lot at the state level, actually, or federal. But anyway, it's a very, how do you like to spend your life with some of these creeps that we hear about on the news all the time who get convicted and get sent to prison for life or whatever? By the way, never believe a life sentence unless you're in a couple of states in the United States. I won't elaborate. But you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. I've already told you can go there and get started that way. And I've already told you who our speaker is tonight. So I think you'll enjoy listening to him. If we have time for some call-ins on in the news section, you know about that. You can call in at 347-996-5983 if you want to do that. We seldom have time for that. I got so many news articles tonight to talk about. We have a blonde joke tonight. Let's get to our blonde joke and see what it sounds like, if I can even find the thing. Where in the world did the blonde joke go? Good question. I know where it is. Okay. All right, here's our blonde joke for this evening.
A blonde walked into a shoe shop and saw a pair of shoes made from alligator skin that she liked. "How much for these shoes?" she asked the store manager.
$200. He replied. "That's too expensive. Can't you bring the price down?" the blonde said. The store manager said he couldn't and got irritated when the blonde persisted. Finally, after arguing with her for a while, he said, "There's a pond with alligators behind the store. Why don't you kill an alligator and get your alligator shoes free?" he yelled. "Fine. I will," the blonde replied. After an hour, the manager got a bit worried that the blonde might have come to harm with the alligators. He decided to go out and check on her. When he arrived at the pond, he saw the blonde lugging a dead alligator and slinging it from the ground next to six other dead ones. Before he could ask what she was doing, she wailed, "Oh my gosh! This one doesn't have any shoe either."
Okay. Thank you very much, Mildred. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a special service announcement that they would like you to hear. They're interested in this announcement being broadcast, and we're faithful in doing that every show that we do, so that the criminals will hear this announcement and go turn in their guns. Here it is.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. That is a very good thing. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, the planet keeps getting warmer. Wait a minute. Okay, Mike, I realize that. The planet, apparently based on research over about the last decade, it keeps getting colder. Now the global warmers are saying that, well, it has to get cold before it can get warm. I think that's probably true. Temperatures do go sort of up and down, but the global warming thing is sort of, it's not over because there's too much money being made with this energy stuff. But we do have a green tip for tonight, and this comes from the little book by Esma Floyd, and it's called 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And I know we haven't had 1001 radio shows. We haven't used all of these yet. So our thing tonight, and I notice people doing that, and it really angers me because I know it's warming the planet. You ever notice people buying, I mean, there's still people that print things in business and universities and government offices, that type of thing. But you ever notice that they use thick paper? I mean, isn't that terrible? I mean, when you go out, throw out thin paper should be what you're using. Always buy the thinnest variety of recycled paper for your printer. The thinner the paper, the less paper is used per sheet, and so wastage is reduced. Save thick versions for very important documents only. So now we need to prioritize our documents based on the importance, and only important documents can now have thin paper. So what a tip. That's a really a great one. But ladies and gentlemen, let's go to some of the news stories tonight, and there's certainly interesting things going on, beyond interesting, that's for sure. It's motivating me to do another book, yes, and here's what this book is going to be about. Have you noticed the 16-year-old girl in Florida who's facing going to prison because she did an experiment at school? She's described as a good kid. She has good grades. She's never been in trouble. She's now facing a felony charge for a science experiment gone wrong. She mixed some household chemicals in an 8-ounce water bottle at school. Excuse me. The experiment resulted in the cap being blown off the bottle and smoke coming out of the top. It was described as a small explosion, you know, like popping a wine bottle or something. Nobody was injured. Nothing was damaged. Kira was her name. Didn't run from what had happened, and she immediately told school administrators what had happened, taking full responsibility. There are no allegations that she intended to hurt anyone or cause any damage whatsoever. All that happened was just like a bottle top popping off. Since, she's been expelled from school and charged with possession and discharge of a weapon on school property, a felony punishable up to 5 years in prison, and discharging a destructive device. Ladies and gentlemen, there are so many of these that we can't count, and what I would like to do is kind of do a collection of books of like the 50 or the 100 stupidest school discipline cases you've ever heard of, and I've got another one coming up. But can you believe that this woman, her entire life could be ruined, this young lady, because she had something happen that was under a school assignment, apparently? And there's no guilty mind here. The commentator in the news story I'm looking at says that. There's no mens rea. That means guilty mind. She didn't intend to harm anyone. And that goes way back into English common law, and it's been the basis in our legal system all the time. And when a statute's kind of ambiguous about things like that, you don't charge somebody with it. I mean, this is ridiculous. But what in the world is going on? Here's a really interesting one. Two Virginia boys are suspended for using their pencils at guns in school. I'm not kidding. Two Suffolk County second graders have been suspended for making shooting noises while pointing pencils at each other. They're 2 7-year-old boys. They're suspended for 2 days for a violation of the Suffolk County zero tolerance policy on weapons. They were playing with one another in class at Driver Elementary School. When I was asked about it, he said, well, I was being a Marine, and the other guy was being a bad guy, said Paul Marshall, one of the boy's fathers. It's as simple as that. And he was making bang-bang noises, pointing his pencil at the other guy. Well, they both got suspended from school. And, of course, the father and folks think this is going a little beyond common sense. I mean, what in the world is going I mean, we're beyond, I guess, it mentions that, we're beyond the Cowboys and Indians days where kids went out on recess and they actually brought a pistol to school, you know, a cap gun or something like that. You couldn't shoot caps, but you could do that back in the Ice Age. But can you imagine this guy now, these two little boys now have a discipline record at their school, and neither one of them had ever been in trouble before. Now, anyway. There are hundreds and hundreds of cases like this across the country, and I think some people need to stand up to these school boards about this corny approach to managing children. I mean, gee, many Christmas. Okay. I want to thank you, first of all, for paying your taxes on this one. We're now our funding of this type of research. The personal automatic cigarette tracker is being developed with taxpayer money. This little device aims to put a breathing sensor in conventional underwear and a hand gesture sensor in a bracelet to detect and record when a person smokes. I'm not kidding. The National Institute of Health has awarded more than $400,000 to a research project involving underwear that can detect when a person smokes cigarettes. I'm not kidding. This may be as stupid as you can get. The University of Alabama has received two grants totaling $402,000 and $402,721 for the project, which so far has produced a very early prototype of the monitoring system in its current state. It fits kind of like a vest, but they want to get it down to the point where it could be like your underwear. And this is called the Personal Automatic PACT. Of course, you have to have an acronym. This is the PACT for short, Personal Automatic Cigarette Tracker. And it's intended to accurately measure when and how often people smoke, as well as how deeply they inhale. The real-time information would be used to design strategies. And this is to overcome what? Surveys. In other words, we found out that we won't have to give surveys now about how much people smoke, because sometimes people don't know, and then sometimes people lie about it. I guess we could also ask the question, who cares? But, of course, I know it's a dangerous thing. Smoking is terrible. But there are people who smoke that survive it. And, you know, depending how liberty-minded you are, then maybe we should allow them to smoke, and we allow them to drive cars, and 36,000, 38,000 people a year are killed that way, too. But can you believe this place has got $400,000 in grant money to develop a pair of underwear that would detect how often you're smoking, and then a bracelet that goes along with it tells you how often you bring the cigarette up to your mouth. What if they know you could cheat on that? You could just bring the bracelet up to your mouth all the time. You know, maybe you could scratch in your jaw or something like that. They'd think that you're actually taking puffs, but you wouldn't be. Unbelievable. Okay, one more big government story. I mean big. There's a new law proposed by the European Commission. Remember them? They would make it illegal to grow, reproduce, or trade any vegetable seeds that have not been tested, approved, and accepted by a new European Union bureaucracy named the EU Plant Variety Agency. I'm not kidding. The EU Plant Variety Agency. And you would be a criminal if you grew seeds in your small home garden, in the back of your house, your apartment, wherever. It would be a crime under the European Union. They would also have to pay gardeners' fees, apparently, to the EU bureaucracy for the registration of their seeds. So they'll get taxes, and they'll control what kind of seeds you can use, and all your seeds have to be tested. I'm going to try that out down in the hills of West Virginia or East Tennessee somewhere. I bet that one won't be real popular. But can you believe it? The European Union, which is a kind of bring people together for a number of good reasons, just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. And what's going to happen with this, it's going to be the same issue as our speaker is talking about tonight. How big can government get? Does it literally control everything we do? It sounds like that may be an intention with the European Union. And I know some people in Europe who are not entirely happy with the European Union. And I think I mentioned once on the show that in Romania, they weren't even allowed to use the term champagne anymore, and they supplied like 80% of Russia's champagne because France, which is one of the controlling three or four nations of the European Union, said that only France could use the term champagne. So that's a bit much, isn't it? But anyway, it's going to be interesting to see how that happens. I hope our Department of Agriculture is not listening and they would come up with that that idea. Here's the last one, and then we'll get to our speaker tonight. But very interesting. Google Glass is going to come out very soon. I'm going to get mine. Google Glass is a little set of glasses that you wear that allows you to take pictures, allows you to search on the internet, allows you to make recordings, that type of thing. And they're a little behind in the production because they keep testing it. And it must be fair. Google is concerned a little bit about some of the privacy issues also, but maybe not enough. And glass-like device that allows users to access the internet, take photos, film short snippets. It's already been preemptively banned by a Seattle bar. Large parts of Las Vegas now will not welcome wearers. You're not a Google Glass. But yeah, you've seen these nutbags walking around with cell phones. They can't stop taking pictures of people. I mean, what in the world is that about? I mean, they just keep walking around taking pictures of people. And, you know, why? What's the purpose? And everybody says, well, you don't have any privacy rights in public. Well, maybe that needs to be changed a little bit. Why in the world? You know, I did that years ago. I can't remember what the thing was called. You had a little tube-like camera you could wear, like glasses on the side, and I'd wear it around the university. And people said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm just recording our session. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, you know, we're not in private. We're out talking on the side of the building, you know. Well, I don't want to do that. There's a cafe in Seattle dive bar, which apparently was the first to ban Google Glass. That's the name of it, Google Glass. But you're going to see a lot about this when it comes out. I don't know what the price is going to be. I heard it's $1,500. You know, those of you been around since the Ice Age know early computers were $2,800, $3,000, that type of thing. So anyway, it's going to be interesting, and they think they're going to be making a fortune for this. Of course, this is going to allow people to drive cars and do all this junk while they're driving. You know, we got the rules against text messaging in virtually every state. But here you'll be able to do it hands-free, and all you're doing is kind of talking and, you know, blinking and that kind of stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Technology has its disadvantages, so let's see what goes on with that. All right, tonight let's go ahead and listen to our speaker. Let's hope everything works. It didn't here the last several weeks, and I think that had to do with the hack on Blog Talk Radio. But I think you'll enjoy the speaker tonight, and he has a very interesting subject to talk about. How large can government get, and should it ever be stopped? I mean, is there just continual? How many federal felonies crimes are there now? There's a book called 3,000 or Three Felonies a Day. There were like 3,200 or something in that time. That book's maybe 7 or 8 years old, or maybe even older than that. And we just keep adding laws and laws and laws and laws. And now we hear people in Congress say this, well, you know, we got to pass the bill before we can read it. And they're talking not only about all kinds of different regulatory regulation, but we're also talking about laws. And they just go, you know, there's the wonderful site called Overcriminalization, where everything gets criminalized. So let's set this up and see if we can listen to this gentleman. I think you'll enjoy his message, even regardless of your politics.
Again, schedule. Up next, James Antle, editor of the Daily Caller News Foundation, presents his thoughts on the dangers of a large federal government. It's about 50 minutes.
You know, a lot of the questions that I get about this book, or why I wrote this book, have to do with the subtitle. The book is called Devouring Freedom. Subtitle is, Can Big Government Ever Be Stopped? So the first question I tend to get is, well, can it? And at the risk of discouraging you all from buying the book, I'm going to let you in on the answer. My answer is yes, but it is possible that it can be stopped. But first of all, there are a lot of other questions that have to be addressed. And in my book, one of the things that I do, it's essentially a story about what are the political prospects of limited government. And when I started writing the book, we did not know who was going to be the next president, but we did know that it was going to be a relevant issue regardless of who won the election. I'm a Massachusetts native myself. I don't think that there was any real danger that government was going to get drastically smaller if Mitt Romney had been elected president. I know that that's a shocking thing for many people to you know, grapple with, but I think that it's clearly the record is the case that that was unlikely. But certainly there is no probability that it was going to get at all smaller if President Obama was reelected as he was. And after the president's reelection, I think a lot of conservatives and libertarians were demoralized, particularly people who thought that Romney was going to win in some kind of a landslide, were worried that Obama's reelection meant that the country had changed in some fundamental, irreversible way. They began to doubt after the 2010 elections had looked pretty good for groups like the Tea Party and for conservative Republicans. They began to doubt that big government actually could be stopped. So that's one of the reasons why I think having this discussion is important. I think that there is no reason for people to give up all hope. I think when you look at the trajectory of American politics in the last few election cycles, it's been very volatile. And we've seen a lot of change in a very short period of time. You're a young audience, but for the most part, but I think you're all old enough to remember the permanent Republican majority that was going to happen after 2004. You remember that? That was going to be ushered in part by the American people's opposition to gay marriage. You remember that? How did either of those things work out? So then by 2006, we were hearing a completely different story. The Democrats retook both houses of Congress. And by 2008, Barack Obama was elected. National Journal called him the most liberal senator, and he easily won the presidential election. So that was supposed to be the permanent Democratic majority. And then 2 years later, there was this Tea Party, quote-unquote, revolution that happened, and Republicans retook the House, gained some seats in the Senate, picked up some governorships, and everybody said, oh, see, Democrats, now they're out. It's going to be a permanent setback for the Democrats. It was so permanent that it lasted about 2 years. So my point in all of this is that politics can change very quickly. And even though we live in a 50-50 country, they say, divided between red and blue, and the electorate is very closely divided, there are still millions of people who went from voting for Barack Obama to supporting candidates who are going to make John Boehner Speaker of the House in a very short period of time. Many Americans are not systematic political thinkers. They go by who they trust. They go by who they like. They go by personality. They go by what they think is credible and who they perceive as having had a successful track record. And when they see something that isn't working in their view, they want to change. And so just as I think the Keynesian liberalism of the Obama administration is ascendant due to the failures, real and perceived, of the Bush administration, I think it is a real opportunity for conservatives and libertarians to capitalize on what will be the real failures of the Obama administration. But there are, I think, a lot of other issues simply before you can even get to the question of whether you can use politics to stop the growth of government or to curtail the growth of government in some way. We have many people who question whether big government is even a problem. Does big government exist as something other than a slogan? You know, there is this view, I call it a sort of liberal form of American exceptionalism, where there are people who argue that having annual deficits that are almost as big as the federal budget when Bill Clinton was president is not really a problem. There are people who argue that having the publicly held debt be a majority of our economy is not really a problem. There are people who argue that the gross federal debt consuming our entire economy, being as big, bigger than our entire economy, isn't a problem. And then you have the unfunded liabilities of our major entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, which are larger by some measures than the world economy. But that's not a problem. And there are usually two arguments that people make to this effect, and I try to address them in Devouring Freedom. One is trust us, we're the government. We'll know what to do before the crisis comes. And the other is, well, there's a sucker born every minute. People will keep buying the treasury bonds. Interest rates will never return to where they were before the financial crisis. The economy will at some point regain some semblance of normal growth. And everything is going to be fine, and there's nothing to worry about. So I think that is something that I think has to be addressed before you can really talk about doing anything politically about the size of the federal government. Secondly, I think there is a sort of divide among the American people. Many Americans are divided even within themselves over what kind of role they want the federal government to perform. There are numerous polls, which I cite in the book, that show that majorities of Americans don't trust the federal government, trust it less than they trust labor unions, big business, other major forces in American life. More Americans, even when you look at the exit polls in the 2012 elections, more Americans said they preferred a smaller government that offered fewer services to a bigger government that offers more services. And those numbers become even more pronounced if you mention the fact that government services are paid for by taxes, and you might have to pay more taxes if you get more government services. But at the same time, many of the same Americans who would answer in a limited government way when asked that question by pollsters do not, in fact, want the federal government to stop doing a lot of the things that it currently does, or they don't see it as having an immediate or near-term cost to them. And so I think there are two examples of this that to me, I think, really encapsulate this well. And I'm going to focus on people who are more conservative rather than more moderate for these examples. The New York Times did a story on the Tea Party, and they quoted a woman named Jodine White, and she said that she was conflicted with these entitlements and things like that. She says, you know, I guess I want my Social Security and smaller government too, which is, you know, there are people who ought to be more familiar with the workings of the federal budget than random people quoted in news stories who nevertheless take this similar viewpoint. Dick Morris, the political consultant who has moved from the Democrats to the Republicans, who is really famous for his predictions of the Romney presidency, that very, you know, energetic, spirited race between Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice that was going to happen. So he has now written a column where he says that Republicans should beat Barack Obama on the issue of government spending. Just don't talk about Medicare and don't talk about Social Security, but you can talk about government spending. Many Republicans would then add to that, don't talk about national defense. The Pentagon budget should also be off limits. The problem with that thinking is that you have now exempted the three largest parts of the federal budget from your critique of federal spending. So these are sort of the divisions and the conflicts and the contradictions that I think any serious proponent of limited government has to contend with. I think there's been this view that's been propounded that limited government is impossible. Anarchists even make this argument. And I would counter to you that limited government is possible but difficult. The fact that there has been limited government in the United States, federal government was a fairly limited government for 150 years, even after the Progressive Era, even after the Civil War, where there was some government growth and there were some impediments to government growth that were institutional that were kind of knocked out of our American political system, we still had a fairly limited federal government. Now, I think the anarchists might have a little bit of a stronger argument when it comes to the sustainability long-term of limited government, especially in a mass democracy or a welfare state. But for the purposes of this discussion, we're going to posit that a somewhat limited government is possible because we've seen it happen before. So I argue in the book that when Republicans have been serious about cutting federal spending, they have had some success in doing so. And I also argue that there are things that we can learn from their attempts because some attempts worked better than others. In each of those cases, though, I would argue to you that they were successful in preventing the United States from becoming a full-blown European-style social democracy. But there were some spending cuts that were more longer term and prevailed for a very long time. And then there were other cuts to government spending that were really restored. The spending was restored right after these Republicans left office and in some cases before. And that, to a large extent, happened under the Reagan administration or after the Reagan administration and after the first couple of years of the Gingrich Congress in the mid-90s. The most successful conservative Congress in history, actually, what in my argument, was the Do-Nothing Congress after World War II, where Robert Taft was the leader of a very successful long-term movement to control federal spending. They didn't repeal the New Deal, but where they decided to strike, they struck decisively. They abolished programs. They didn't trim them. They eliminated price controls and the militarization of the U.S. economy. They didn't sort of tinker around its edges. They cut military spending. They also prevented the enactment of something that was in the way to the left of Obamacare, a British National Health Service style of national health care that was being supported by the Truman administration. They didn't have a lot of public opinion on their side. They didn't have a friendly president. They had a very hostile president in Harry Truman, who was a firm believer in the New Deal consensus. But nevertheless, they were successful. One reason, however, why their work has not been replicated very often is that politically they were the least successful. Ronald Reagan was reelected. The Republicans held the Senate during the Reagan years until the 1986 elections. After the Gingrich elections, the Republicans controlled the House until the 2006 election. So they had the House for 12 years and the Senate for most of that time period. The Do-Nothing Congress was voted out in the very next election. But in terms of actually saving this country from a much bigger government and making it possible for us to even have the debates that we were having with Reagan and Gingrich, I don't think you could argue with their success. I don't talk much in the book about Calvin Coolidge. One reason for that is simply marketing. There are at least three books that I know of on Coolidge right now. But the second reason, though, and somewhat more important, is that Coolidge governed during a period where limited government was still the political norm in the United States, which I don't think is applicable to today. He was certainly scaling back some advances of the state during the Progressive Era, from the Progressive Era, but he succeeded a president that also wanted to return to normalcy in the person of Warren G. Harding. And what he was doing really was the political norm up to that point. We didn't have the advanced federal welfare state that we developed after the New Deal. So I simply didn't think that the example of Coolidge, while there are many things we could learn from him, were as relevant to the contemporary political debate as some of the later examples. I think, though, it is a mistake if we exclusively blame President Obama for the size and cost and scope of the federal government. President Obama came to office during a period of economic crisis where there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of desire on the part of the American people to have their problems, economic and financial, addressed by government. We had just had a financial meltdown, the Great Recession. And to paraphrase White House Chief of Staff, you never let a crisis go to waste. And they didn't let a crisis go to waste. And it would be unusual to expect anything else. And certainly the growth of government in the first 2 years of the Obama administration was worse by an order of magnitude than anything we'd seen in recent years. But I would argue to you where we really got off course fiscally was before there was Barack Obama, and before there was even George W. Bush. The Republicans who controlled Congress lost their commitment to fiscal discipline by 1998. They felt that they had lost the government shutdown battle, and then eventually the internal disputes within among congressional Republicans in favor of reining in government spending, particularly dealing with entitlements. The more big government Republicans, the go-along-to-get-along Republicans, won that debate within the party. Then you were followed by George W. Bush, who believed that a big political liability for the GOP was the fact that they attempted some budget cuts in the first 2 years of the Gingrich Congress. He made the statement that he didn't want to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. He talked about compassionate conservatism. He was going to be a different kind of Republican. Unfortunately, he really wasn't a different kind of Republican, because if you look at the experience of the Nixon administration, the first Bush administration, the Ford administration, growing government has kind of been the norm, it has been the trend. But George W. Bush, I think, took it to another level, because he was a guns and butter spending increase president. And I think he really undercut the GOP's credibility on any of these issues, including from some of the more promising young Republicans who were coming of age at the time President Bush was in office. But the fact that the Republican Party is branded as a small government party, however inaptly, meant that the failures of big government under the Bush administration tarred rhetoric of limited government, tarred the ideas of limited government, and paved the way for even bigger government. The Iraq War, the Medicare prescription drug benefit, No Child Left Behind, these were very, very costly federal interventions. And it is very difficult, I think, to argue that Republicans were upholding some kind of small government ideals during that time period. Most of all, I think you see with the fact that the Republicans did not really attempt to address a lot of the issues that President Obama ultimately came to office arguing that he was going to address. There was the perception that the GOP had failed on foreign policy, a perception that I agree with. There was also the fact that the Republicans did not do anything about the health care issue, did not do anything to promote a genuine free market in health care, which I talk about in my book. And as a result of that, it made it inevitable that when it came time to deal with the health care issue, it would be dealt with on Democratic terms. Republicans, however rarely they have launched full frontal assaults on the size and scope of the federal government, have on occasion tried indirect routes to limiting the federal government. During the Reagan years, we had the sort of supply-side revolution, where the idea would be that we would cut marginal tax rates, which were then very onerous. The top marginal tax rate was 70%. There were over 14 tax brackets in the individual income tax code. It was definitely a time for some cutting, and the hope was that the economic growth that tax cuts and deregulation would unleash would allow a sort of covert assault on federal spending. The Reagan administration, with the help of a bipartisan conservative majority in the House and a Republican Senate, had a great deal of success in cutting non-defense domestic discretionary spending. They did relatively little, however, about entitlements, and they increased defense spending. So we saw larger deficits, somewhat larger government, although some of the discretionary spending cuts and the economic growth did slightly cut the government's share of the private economy. And we saw while Reagan was office, when it came time to deal with the deficit, that too was something that we ended up doing on Democratic terms, with tax increases that began to wipe out much of the Reagan tax cuts before Reagan even left office, and then sharply curtailing the Reagan tax cuts when Bush 41 was in office, raising the top marginal income tax rate. So that approach did not really shrink the federal government. The next approach that was used was the theory of starve the beast, which in some ways contradicts the supply side argument because of the Laffer curve. But we were in a slightly different place. But instead of now arguing that tax cuts would increase revenues, we began to argue that tax cuts will reduce revenues, but that will mean that the federal government has less money to spend, and therefore it will spend less. I think that argument is half right, in that if you give the federal government more money, it will find a way to spend it. But the history of the 2000s, I think, conclusively showed that it actually made the growth of government seem like it was cost-free. Even though deficit spending is really taxation deferred rather than taxation denied, it does make the current generation of voters feel like they're getting something for nothing. Even at the tail end of the Reagan administration, we had it at one point where the government was charging very low tax rates while we still had a post-New Deal, post-Great Society welfare state. David Frum, back when he was much more libertarian than he is today, described it as post-Great Society government at pre-Great Society prices. So that was something of a failure in terms of cutting government and limiting government. The final thing is divided government, which has been very successful in curtailing the growth of government. It certainly was in the 90s when you had divided government between Clinton and congressional Republicans. And I'd argue we're starting to see some degree of success with that now with the Republican House and Democrats controlling the other two, controlling the Senate and the White House. But to actually address the long-term drivers of the debt and to keep the federal government from continuing to grow, there are going to need to be some systematic reforms to entitlements. And under the current political conditions, it's very difficult to see how those things could be accomplished through divided government today. There was a period in the 90s where it looked like there might be an opportunity for that because we had a centrist Democratic president and a Republican Congress, and you had a number of people talking about entitlement reform and other things. But today, I think there are very different views of what role of government actually stimulates the economy. We've moved from the Reaganomics of the Clinton administration, which argued that deficit reduction stimulated the economy, to, I think, returning to the post-New Deal liberal consensus view that deficit spending and increased government spending are stimulative of the economy. So in that kind of climate, I find it very difficult to see how divided government will produce the much-hoped-for grand bargain that will end up taming the entitlements problem and dealing with our impending debt problems. So where does that sort of leave us? I argue in the book that there are a new generation of Republican leaders, people like Rand Paul, Justin Amash, Mike Lee, who are much more serious about these issues and have shown that they can be creative in ways of speaking out about these issues and being committed to principle on these issues. I think regardless of what you thought about the merits of Rand Paul's filibuster on the drones, what you thought of the merits of the drone issue, I think it's striking that his filibuster produced by some measures a 50-point swing in public opinion on that issue. Now, I'm not arguing to you that if Rand Paul or Paul Ryan got up and talked about Medicare premium support or block granting Medicaid for 13 hours that all of a sudden those things would happen. But I think it's an example of how thinking creatively about these issues really open political opportunities that even opinion leaders don't really see. More, even more important, though, than principled leadership, because I think there's a limit to the number of principled rather than self-interested politicians you're ever going to find. It is important to have groups like FreedomWorks and Young Americans for Liberty and Club for Growth and all these maligned Tea Party activist groups and the Heritage Act, Americans for Tax Reform, so many other groups that are making it a bad career move for Republicans to be for big government. As big of a debacle as Christine O'Donnell being nominated was, if in the long term Republicans don't think the best career move for them, even in blue states, is to be the person behind cap and trade, person who was willing to contemplate perhaps not repealing Obamacare, if people no longer feel that that is the way to get ahead politically, we will see less big government Republicanism over time. Milton Friedman, to paraphrase him, argued that the most important thing in politics isn't trying to elect the right people so they'll do the right things. It's changing the political incentives so that the wrong people will do the right things. And I think that that is really the vital work that a lot of organizations do. I think many of these organizations need to think more in terms of how next to reach the persuadable middle and to address and to get them to understand that this is not obstructionism for obstructionism's sake, that opposition to big government is not simply trying to frustrate President Obama's domestic agenda because conservatives just want to or are incorrigible or contrarian. But, you know, that we actually have an opportunity to maybe fight big government in a way that people understand that there are reasons that will benefit them in terms of their personal liberty, their personal freedom, and their prosperity, their checkbook at the end of the day. I think one sort of telling Republican leader who I talk about in my book is Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, really demonstrates the disconnect between the aspirations of the GOP and the actual track record of the GOP. I give Ryan a lot of credit for being almost alone in talking about the need for entitlement reform when you know that the political reaction is going to be pictures of you shoving grandma off the cliff in a wheelchair. And I think that when you look at the long term of the final destination of where things like the roadmap and the path to prosperity will take you, even though I may have some quibbles with specific decisions he makes on how to get there, I do feel that much of what he's proposing will represent the right side of the possible in terms of limiting the federal government. However, when you look at many of the votes Ryan cast over the course of his career, he was very supportive of increasing government under Republican presidents and Republican Congresses. Medicare Part B, he was instrumental in getting that passed. He was instrumental in passing the Wall Street bailout. He was instrumental in passing the automakers bailout. I have some theories as to why that might be the case. Paul Ryan was elected to Congress in 1998. That was the year that the conservative backbenchers in the House conclusively lost their fight with the Republican establishment over whether we were going to cut spending. If you look back at people who had clawed their way from the backbenches to being in leadership, it was people like Newt Gingrich, who are now that establishment, who was cracking down on the conservatives who continued to want to cut spending. My view is that Ryan believed that taking a traditional path to power, impressing people with his intellect and his interest in the budget issues and the fiscal policy, but at the same time voting in line with what the party leadership wanted and rising in a traditional way, I think that he believed that that was the way that he was going to be able to best influence the party and best influence the country. The danger to that is, if you never have anything like the Ryan plan enacted, but you do have Medicare Part B and that is always with you, that is the danger of that. But I think when you look at the trajectory of somebody like Paul Ryan, I think that that's going to say a lot about where the Republican Party as a whole ends up. And I think the direction of the Republican Party is really crucial to this debate, because in contemporary political terms, I don't see any movement towards a more restrained federal government from Democrats. Even on the civil liberties issues where liberal Democrats have at times tended to be more respectful of personal freedoms than some conservative Republicans, it's clearly not the issue that animates them or really drives them. There was only one Democrat who participated in the poll drone filibuster. There were only a handful of Democrats that were active in getting rid of the indefinite detention provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act. Democrats, was a minority of Democrats in both houses on the Patriot Act, on FISA, on a number of these different issues. So I think the direction of the Republican Party is very important. So I talk about the main obstacle. There are numerous obstacles to limiting government that are institutional, that are deep in public opinion, that have to do with the media, and I talk about all of those in my book. But I think the most important thing is, do we have two big government parties as we currently do, or do we have a small government or relatively limited government party to contest the party of big government? And that's an area where I think things may change. I think when Paul Ryan decided that was elected to Congress, there wasn't a lot of precedent for people succeeding as congressional backbenchers. But since then, we've seen Mike Pence go from opposing the Republican leadership on a lot of issues to joining the Republican leadership and eventually becoming governor of Indiana. Jeb Hensarling from Texas voted against the leadership on a number of issues and then ultimately joined the leadership. We saw Jim DeMint from South Carolina become a very important kingmaker in the Senate, having a lot of influence on the composition of the Republican conference, while voting against the party leadership. And soon he is, maybe even today he was inaugurated, I'm not sure. Very soon he is going to be taking over as president of the Heritage Foundation, one of the more important conservative think tanks in Washington and in the country as a whole. And then in 2008, we saw the ultimate congressional backbencher in the form of Ron Paul, the person of Ron Paul, show that you can have a lasting impact on the debate and a lasting impact on the party, where there's now even an entire wing of the party that is influenced by Ron Paul, and issues like Federal Reserve and a less interventionist foreign policy and civil liberties issues that simply weren't even getting a hearing in the Bush-era GOP. So I think that is really where the action is going to be going forward. But the final thing I would say in terms of opportunities for limiting the federal government is, if you really look at when conservatives and libertarians have been successful in the past, it has really always been in response to liberal misgovernment. To people always like big government when it's free, but soon we're going to see the middle class begin to pay some of its costs. And that is really the circumstances under which the social revolutions of the 1960s and the 1970s gave way to, however limited, the conservative reforms of the 1980s and 1990s, to a point where you had even Democratic presidents talking about the era of big government being over, deficit reduction being the best thing for the economy, and actually talking a little bit about entitlement reform. Unfortunately, nothing really happened. So that transformation may be seen through Obamacare. Obamacare will do one of two things. Obamacare will be the policy that drives us into a permanent state of big government that no political activism will be able to reverse or contain, or it will be the issue where big government so conspicuously fails for millions of Americans that it forces people in another direction. Neither response is inevitable. Obamacare, there's a lot of pressure among even Republicans to sort of say that Obamacare is a settled issue after the president was reelected, after the Supreme Court had its decision, thanks in part to a Republican appointed justice. But there are going to be a lot of problems in the implementation of Obamacare. We're already seeing that the implementation of Obamacare is problematic. We've even repealed portions of Obamacare already, the 1099 requirements, the medical devices tax, with Democratic support, with bipartisan support. Keeping Obamacare...
Well, going into Obamacare takes us into a large subject. And I would see this book generally, for those who are listening and have not heard of James Antle, as sort of an introduction to big government, what it does, how it can be contained. And he didn't use this exact analogy, but it's kind of like, you don't want to throw everybody out, or you can't throw everybody out on the opposing party and people that don't go along with you, but you can envision and implement methods that control them. So it's kind of like training your dog. You know, you don't get rid of Fido just because he or she doesn't do everything you want. You sort of train them and implement, devices and means that will keep them under control. So Antle has some ideas about that in his book, that's for sure. Well, that's about it for tonight. And hope you enjoyed listening to a little bit of that. And we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off one more time as she sings "We'll Meet Again." See you next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. our world.